We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs Director. This is a salary full-time position paying $31,400 a year. The full job descriptions and instructions for applying can be found on our website on the homepage on the right-hand side under News from the Boo. That's at KBOO.FM on the homepage, right-hand side, under News from the Boo. Applications are due Friday, November 20th at 5 p.m.
KBOO is proud to host the entire series of the podcast, The Spirit of the Forest, an audio drama, dark comedy, and semi-musical outsider art program. It's created by independent producer Dan Krall from Corvallis, and the program reflects upon the sadness, the absurdity, and normalcy of modern life. Listen to The Spirit of the Forest on demand at kboo.fm/thespiritoftheforest.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hello, this is Fernando Gapacin. This is KBOO Labor Radio. The host for tonight is myself, Fernando Gapacin, and Ann McDonald, and she's not here right now. And our special guest tonight is Jamie Partridge, retiree from the Postal Workers and one of the co-petitioners for 15 now ballot measure. We'll be talking tonight about the recent Oregon AFL-CIO convention and some of the resolutions and some insights that Jamie and I are going to share. We were both delegates at that convention. And we're going to listen first to some interviews that Jamie did with some of the delegates from the convention.
This is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. I'm here talking with Amanda Hill of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, who works at Kaiser, and she was at the mic at the Oregon AFL-CIO convention in favor of the $15 minimum wage initiative. Amanda, tell us why you support the $15 minimum wage initiative.
I have a daughter in college who's going to have to pay back a lot of student loans, and if she doesn't make at least $15 an hour, she's not going to be able to do that. I'm not ready for her to come back home and live with me.
Tell us what you said at the microphone.
Well, basically, I said that, using the calculator, the family budget calculator that the Economic Policy Institute put out, in order for us to survive on $13.50, we're either going to have to move to Oklahoma, Tennessee, Minnesota, or Nebraska, because in the state of Oregon, you need at least $14.18. So, raising the wage to $15 would at least give us the chance to save for our retirement, help fund college, and prepare for any emergency that might show up.
All right. Thank you, Amanda Hill. And I've got Tina Turner-Morfitt here with me from AFSCME, Council 75 and the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tina, you spoke at the mic in support of the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. Tell us about what you said.
Well, basically what I said right now, while the unions are out trying to coalesce with the communities, trying to convince community people that unions are for them, what I said to the delegates today is that we have to be true to that. We can't go and bargain a $15 minimum wage for our members, but then do something less for the community who are non-union workers. If we want to win folks over, we have to do it in good deeds, and a good deed is to fight for a minimum wage of $15. We can't have it both ways.
So there was quite a bit of debate here about the difference between the $13.50 ballot initiative and the $15 ballot initiative. How do you feel about the outcome of the vote here?
Well, you know, I'm really encouraged by the vote, but again, a lot will depend on what happens from this point forward. We have some very dedicated individuals out there who are grass union workers, and they are out there really trying to move this issue, and that's the only reason the issue is still alive. And so I think if we have our sister unions get out there and start supporting them by giving them funds, by encouraging our members to get out there in front of 15 now, then I think we'll demonstrate to the public that we're not just talking out of both sides of our mouth. I mean, they see what's happening on TV. They see when we're able to negotiate a $15 minimum wage for union workers who are already represented. But if they hear us, if we go out there and we fight for something less, like $13.50 for them, then they're going to say, why aren't I good enough?
Thank you very much, Tina Turner Morford of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. All right, we're talking with Ann McDonald, who's a delegate here at the Oregon AFL-CIO Convention for Laborers Local 483. And you were at the microphone in favor of the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. Why don't you tell us what you said?
Yes, well, there were two initiatives, one to support 15 and one to support raising the minimum wage, just kind of generally. And Jamie, when you moved to amend that resolution to specifically add 15, I moved to support that amendment, not because I'm against, quote unquote, a significant increase in Oregon's minimum wage, but because I know resources are finite and I think those resources should be focused on winning 15. I've been a proud member of 483 since 2 years ago when I helped organize the food service workers at the Oregon Zoo. While we were organizing, my dad, back in Arkansas, warned me not to trust the unions. He said they'd make a bunch of empty promises, then just collect my dues. I told my dad he was wrong, that the union never made us any promises. Our field organizer only promised that they'd fight like hell to help us get a fair contract. He said we could only win what we were willing to fight for. After enough of us signed a petition, I was really impressed when our bargaining team put 15 on the table for a bunch of temporary workers. It felt like we were joining a national movement. 15 had just won in Seattle and was making headlines nationwide. We didn't get 15 at the zoo because there had been too much turnover in the year since the organizing drive, too many layoffs, and too many new people who didn't know anything about unions or so-called right-to-work legislations or Friedrichs versus California Teacher Association, any of it. I hadn't heard about that before I joined the Zoolidarity campaign. When we won our first contract last year, many of us got our first raises in 4 years. I went from $11.28 to $13.10. I was glad for the raise and everything we got, but it wasn't enough to live on. I'm a college graduate, paying back loans, single with no kids, sharing a house with a few other people, and still struggling to get by. My savings is spent every time my car breaks down. Aside from Goodwill, I'm rarely spending any money in my local businesses, and I can't afford to fly home once a year to visit my family, and it's not because I'm uneducated or unwilling to work hard. This year, I used up all of my temporary hours working as a gardener at the zoo. The stress was half that of a restaurant lead, but the pay started at almost $20 an hour. Finally, I could pay for the basic living expenses in life. I could pay off my credit card, and I really start paying down my student loans. Importantly, I could set aside enough in savings to soften the blow of my eventual layoff. And now, for the first time, I'm in this funny position where I can collect as much in unemployment as I could working part-time at my old wages. So I'm here today because I still believe in those temporary, seasonal, part-time contingent workers at the zoo, at Portland Parks and Rec, everywhere. I know they deserve better pay, but more importantly, I know they need to believe in themselves to feel empowered and to be inspired. The highest minimum wage possible, quote-unquote, is not inspiring. Bernie Sanders, the favorite of the progressive movement now, is inspiring people today. Bernie stands with 15. City workers in Milwaukee just won 15. Home care workers won 15. I know we can win 15 in Oregon, but we have to be willing to fight for it. I'm a public employee. I know we can't afford to waffle now, not with what we're facing next year, a potential huge backslide in the victories I know many of the delegates here have spent years fighting for. We need public support. We need to build solidarity within our ranks, among our members, and within our communities. When I began to volunteer for the 15 campaign, the battle cry that inspired me was 15 and a union. I believe every Oregonian who works for a living deserves a shot at 15 and a union. If the entirety of the Oregon AFL-CIO puts its full might behind that battle cry, we have a real shot at victory. And I'd love to fight with everybody here, all of us, to win it. Thank you.
All right, Ann McDonald with Laborers 483. And if just so that our listeners are aware, you have an opportunity to join this all-volunteer grassroots rank-and-file effort to collect signatures to put the $15 minimum wage on the ballot. Just go to our website at Oregonians for 15 and sign up to volunteer, and we'll be in touch with you. Oregonians for 15.org. So I'm here talking with Wyatt McMinn from Painters Local 10 and Rebecca Lewis from IATSE, the Stagehands Union, Local 28, okay, who put forward resolution number 617, which was one of the more controversial resolutions here at the state convention. Wyatt, tell us about what it is and why you put it forward.
The resolution is called Mobilizing Union Power Against Right to Work Union Busting. The spirit of the resolution is actually pretty much about not focusing on ballot measures or politicians or Democrats or anything like that at all. It's more about actually using unions as working class self-defense organizations we actually were to actually really fight and stop horrible people who want to smash the union movement. We thought it was important. Us, IATSE, and a couple other locals decided to bring this too because we feel there's a big lack of actually really direct action against these horrible anti-worker laws are going to get and pass through. And we sort of felt like the AFL-CIO is not doing everything in their power to actually really confront and really fight right to work.
Well, why don't you briefly explain for those of our listeners who are not familiar with what right to work means, what that is?
So right to work means a lot of things, actually. There's many different versions of it. It's not even called right to work. On the ballot initiatives that are up for consideration in Oregon, it's called workplace freedom and something else that I can't remember. They're union busting initiatives. There are a few ballot measures that have been considered, but there's also a possible Supreme Court decision which could rule nationally that unions do not have the right to collect fair share money from represented workers who choose not to join the union. And what that would do is essentially create an open shop situation for workers in the places that it affects. If it's national, it would be everywhere. Some of them only pertain to public sector workers, but in Wisconsin, there's now some legislation that pertains to private sector workers as well. Home care workers in the Pacific Northwest are now working in open shop conditions because of a previous court decision which exempts them from some of the rules that are applied to other private workers.
What's been the impact of these right to work laws in places that have been that where it's been implemented, like in Wisconsin or Indiana?
It tends to double workplace mortality. So death at work, it increases safety violations. In many cases, it's depressed wages. There's lots of ill effects from it. It also creates a situation where collective bargaining is very difficult. If you don't have a closed shop, it's basically impossible to bargain collectively because you're working alongside people who aren't bound by the same rules that you are. But really what it does is it takes away the power that people have as collectively organized union members to fight alongside of each other. It takes a chunk of that collective power away by outlawing it, essentially.
So what is it that the AFL is committed to doing, and what were you recommending that they do?
In my opinion, messaging, I think, is very important to the AFL-CIO about how we actually talk about right to work, or how we talk about unions actually who are under attack about right to work. And I just had major disagreements with it. It's what they want to do too, sort of, since unions aren't that, there's not that many people in anymore because we're under attack, you know, we have to make it more about workers' rights, which is true. But we have to be very clear with especially our membership that, you know, this is an attack on unions, and unions are at the head of the workers' movement because they protect all workers. Our resolution to that was destroyed, actually. It lost pretty bad. Actually goes against that. We think that the way you're going to mobilize our membership in the unions who aren't engaged is actually by doing something and showing them that the union is our self-defense organization, and we can shut them down and we can stop them, but we have to do that. And it's unfortunate too that the AFL-CIO doesn't really want to talk about what's actually in our arsenal, like going out on strike, if the stuff asks, like, you know, directly confronting these horrible, disgusting anti-labor groups that are trying to push through these ballot initiatives that are backed by all the rich boys.
So you were proposing in particular that the AFL prepare, or regionally unions prepare for a work stoppage action. And what was the response to that?
Well, first off, we don't say it in the resolution. I heard a lot too that we called for a general strike in the resolution, which we don't. We actually say we have to prepare ourselves with possibly striking, or we're going to have to strike if this stuff does, you know, pass through. Against the law or not against the law, it's not going to matter to stand like really, really strong and have a very clear line if we want to fight this, or we're going to have another Wisconsin.
Thank you, Wyatt McGrinn and Rebecca Lewis of Painters Local 10 and IATSE Stagehands Local 28. And I'll just end this segment by saying that the reason that we have, this is what I said on the floor also of the convention, that we have a union shop, closed shops, the reason that we have fair share for public employees is because we have gone on strike. The strike wake of the 30s, which were mostly illegal, won the union shop in the private sector, and the strike wave of the 70s in the public sector was what won fair share, and almost all of these strikes were illegal, and workers flocked to unions as their strikes won real gains, and the public, which is 70% working class, will support strikes if we message them correctly and show that we're striking for them. So that does it for this segment of Labor Radio, and thanks for tuning in tonight.
This is KBOO Portland 90.7. This is Labor Radio of, by, and for the working class. My guest tonight is Jamie Partridge from the Postal Workers and petitioner for 15 now. Jamie, I wanted to ask about 15 now. It's been catching on. I mean, SeaTac, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, as they mentioned, Milwaukee. People are really getting jazzed up about this. I know that service workers, fast food workers, seem to be energized and organizing. There's a bigger impact on the fight for 15 than simply raising the minimum wage. People are getting excited about this.
Yeah, well, the reason that I got involved, not being a low-wage worker myself, I'm actually a retiree, but a 40-year member of the labor movement, is this is the most exciting thing that's come along for a while. These fast food workers striking first in New York City 3 years ago for Fight for 15 in a union, and then from across the country, city after city, with the help of the Service Employees International Union, but taking the risk of losing their jobs without a union, without union protection, going on strike, mostly unfair labor practice strikes, but demanding 15 in a union, and to the point where last April there were fast food workers on strike and other low-wage workers, child care workers, airport workers, in 250 cities, 60,000 workers on strike on April 15th. And then, of course, we started winning policy changes. When Seattle or SeaTac was first, the ballot initiative for 15 at the small town where the SeaTac airport is, but then Seattle and, as you said, San Francisco, LA, and now New York. The fast food workers in New York have won the whole state, a path to 15, and unions are starting to all kinds of different unions are starting to demand 15 and winning, like the home care workers here in the state of Oregon. 24,000 home care workers have now won a path to 15 through their union, the Service Employees, SEIU. And then city workers, City of Portland, county workers, Multnomah County, Metro, as you said, Milwaukee, City of Milwaukee, other cities, Mountain View, California, just last week.
Wow.
Yeah, that's Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
So now the janitors and the domestics and who service Silicon Valley can actually live where they work. But yeah, it's a national movement that's winning every day. And the only reason that these policy changes are happening at the government level is because of the workers willing to strike, low-wage workers really taking the action. And tomorrow, Tuesday, the 10th of November, we're expecting a national day of action. We're expecting low-wage workers to go out on strike in 270 cities. I've heard more, actually. And in Portland, for those of you who would like to participate, at noon, we're meeting in O'Brien Square, which is Southwest 9th and Stark, the focus will be on justice for janitors, but there will also be actions involving parks and recreation workers, City of Portland, also home care workers in the private sector who are fighting for 15. So it's a national day of action in the fight for 15 in a union, and in Portland, noon at O'Brien Square at Southwest 9th and Stark. And we're also, as you mentioned, taking the fight forward with our ballot initiative, but also we're going to Salem to beat up on legislators next week. I'll mention that. I'll just give you the details. Give our listeners the details. If people want to jump on the bus, go with us to Salem on Monday the 16th. We're leaving at 10:30 a.m. From the Service Employees Local 49 Hall on Southeast 26, just south of Powell, 3536 Southeast 26th. We're getting on a bus, going to be lobbying, or as we call it, marching through the Capitol in our red t-shirts, our 15 Now t-shirts, advocating not only for 15, for the legislature to pass a $15 minimum wage, but to lift the preemption which prohibits cities and counties from raising their minimum wages above that of the state. Here, Portland is not able to do what Seattle and San Francisco did. It's prohibited by a preemption that was imposed by, it's in about 19 different states, and it was imposed in 2001 when conservatives controlled the legislature and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, brought in this legislation which preempted, that is, disallowed cities and counties from raising their own minimum wages, as well as other things like prohibited them from imposing rent control or other types of progressive legislation on a city level. So we're going to be in Salem on the 16th to demand the lifting of the preemption on which prohibits cities and counties from raising their minimum wages as well. So we encourage folks, if they're interested in being involved, to go to our website, which is OregoniansFor15.org, OregoniansFor15.org, and get involved.
You know, since the changes in the U.S. economy, specifically deindustrialization, the breakdown of unionized industry, the economy has actually been increasingly in favor of the 1%, and as Anne McDonald clearly raised the notion that these folks that follow the rules, they go to school, they do everything they're supposed to, and they're still broke. And the thing is that during the start of this shift, a lot of progressive economists had talked about how with the demise of industry in the United States, that service would have to be paid more in order to drive the economy. And where this all came became very clear was during the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
As I see it, many of the activists that came out of the Occupy movement are part of the 15 Now organizing. So there's a connection. There's momentum growing.
Absolutely. And there's this whole low wage workforce. A lot of them, people who have some kind of college, are now stuck with college debt and have no way of paying it off. And this precarious workforce is the basis of the fight for 15, as well as you said, the Occupy movement, and an understanding that wage inequality is exploding in this country. And in the last 10 years, almost all the raises in income have gone to the 1%.
You know, this your interviews also mentioned Friedrichs, and I think the Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association case, what it is essentially is the potential of overturning another case called Abode versus the Detroit school district. And what this is about is, in Abode, the court ruled that agency shop was legal, meaning that if unions gain recognition in a public sector bargaining unit, that they actually have the right to charge service fees. Those are fees for the services that are provided to all workers in the public sector. What Friedrichs threatens to do is to wipe out or eliminate the ability of unions to create agency shop clauses in their contracts. Now, Oregon Ask Me estimates that roughly 18% immediately, a Supreme Court case, once it's ruled upon, the day that the ruling is given is when the law goes into effect. So in June of 2016, which is the time that it's estimated that Friedrichs will be decided, unions in Oregon are liable to lose roughly 20% of their revenue almost immediately. And when you think about the overall impact systematically, many of these unions could run the risk of losing 50 to 60% of their revenue, which means stifling the voice of workers within that state. In Wisconsin, when this occurred through legislation, with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, went from 68,000 members to 12,000 members. And their political power diminished accordingly. And what we have seen in these places where these kinds of legislation has gone through is ultimately the demise of union power overall, or union membership. So it calls upon us to understand that what we're really fighting is for the voice of working people and for a democratic society. And I think what some of the folks from the painters and from IOTSE were talking about is a re-education by the unions, for the unions. And in Wisconsin, there was debate about whether or not a general strike would be necessary in order to stop the snowball effect of the anti-union forces. It was felt that people were not prepared, or they didn't have the structure or the education to be able to conduct such a dramatic and necessary action. What the proposal was, as I remember it, was that education begins, that we need the education and we need to be able to involve the public in understanding the benefits that unions provide.
Yeah, and I think that the unions now have to be as open and mobilized as possible, that we need to be organizing informational rallies. We need to be talking in every workplace. We need to get union members and their allies out on picket lines and in marches and holding hearings and town halls about this attack on working people. And when we organize like that, we learn how to stick together, and we can actually consider something like striking, political striking, to fight this right to work Friedrich decision that's coming in June. The Supreme Court was influenced by the strike wave of the 1970s. By 1975, all that whole period of time, so in the early 70s, public sector workers were striking illegally and were functioning without a fair share, without fair share, without agency shop, without being able to collect dues from everybody. The Supreme Court was influenced by this strike wave, which by 1975 is when the Abode decision came down. So the Supreme Court is impacted by what happens in society, and the way that the labor movement is either mobilized or demobilized. So certainly we have to organize to fight the elections. The problem with the ballot initiatives coming our way in the state of Oregon, but we also need to mobilize to fight this Supreme Court decision.
Thank you, Jamie. This is Labor Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take